Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and today is part one of our conversation with Ross Cohen. He's an Alaskan historian and author of three books, including The Long View, Dispatches on Alaska History. Our conversation today is on the birth of the Alaskan city, and I asked Ross about the early challenges for Americans wanting to settle here.
Well, you know, the first challenge, of course, is environmental, right? I mean, Alaska is a very forbidding climate, very forbidding landscape, geographical challenges to road building and city building that aren't experienced, you know, down in California, for example. And so I think, you know, emigrants to Alaska, particularly in that early American period, really devised some interesting ways to settle Alaska, and I acknowledge that settle is sort of a problematic word because, of course, Alaska had already been settled for the previous 10,000 years by Alaska Natives. But nevertheless, when these non-Native immigrants arrived, they really brought with them ideas and strategies for communities and for road building from downstate. You know, this was not a reinvention of the wheel. This is very, very much a continuation of the practices downstate, but with maybe an Alaska twist on it. And now, the example that I'm thinking of here is Fairbanks. Some of your listeners may be aware, you know, Fairbanks was founded in 1902. It was a gold rush town. You know, you had Felix Pedro, the miner, out there in the hills and the creeks prospecting for gold, and then E.T. Barnett arrives on the steamship and builds the town on the banks of the Chena River. And what makes this such an interesting example is that those two men and those two regions represent a really interesting contrast as to how land is developed and how Alaska was settled. Fairbanks itself grows up on the south bank of the Chena River, and Barnett and his compatriots, you know, they lay out First Avenue and then Second Avenue and then Third Avenue, and then there are streets running perpendicular away from the river. And so Fairbanks really develops the way almost every town in the American West did, and that's along this grid. It's often called the Jeffersonian grid, right? Thomas Jefferson abhorred cities. He was a ruralist all the way, but he nevertheless believed that a city was like an organic being that provided for its residents the democratic ideal. That is to say, when a street is, or when a community is laid out with these parallel and perpendicular streets creating blocks, and when each individual is afforded the opportunity to own a lot on that block, it essentially becomes like a symbiotic relationship where the health of every resident is dependent on the health of those around him or her. That is to say, if your neighbor prospers and has a nice house, then you're likely to as well, and the reverse is also true. And this is what Thomas Jefferson held as a democratic ideal for cities, that all people would have a stake in the health of the community. And by taking care of their own needs, they would contribute to the community as large, and everyone benefits. That's how Fairbanks develops, with First Avenue, Second Avenue, Cushman Street, Lacey Street forming rigid blocks. Now, contrast that then with Felix Pedro and Tom Gilmore and the other miners who were 12 miles north of the Chena River prospecting for gold in the hills and the creeks. They didn't lay out streets, of course. They didn't do anything by these sort of arrow straight lines the way that the people in Fairbanks were, but rather they were operating by sort of a different geography and a different relationship with the land. They defined ownership in terms of claims on the creeks, the rounded hills, the trails that cut through a path in the hills, or a trail that followed the riverbank for a ways and then broke off and went a different direction for whatever reason, whether it was geographical or whether it was to a hot springs or what have you. And so you don't have those arrow straight roads and rectangular blocks up in the hills. You have a pattern of settlement based on the geography and the contours of the land. Those are very two different patterns of settlement, but very complementary in many ways, because they were fulfilling or purported to fulfill the needs of the residents. Those who lived in town in Fairbanks needed these straight streets and avenues. Those who were prospecting up in the hills needed this more rounded, more geographically diverse system of ownership and settlement. And so both patterns worked for both sets of individuals. This, then, is a story that we see replicated not just in Fairbanks, but in Juneau, in Sitka, in Ketchikan, even in Anchorage with its arrow straight streets and avenues downtown, and then it sort of sprawls out as it gets closer to the hills. This may seem like an obvious, trivial point, but the construction of these roads and trails and the manner with which we live and coexist with one another actually has profound implications for how we operate as a society, how we view our neighbors, how we view ourselves in relation to this community in which we inhabit.
How does a community like Fairbanks evolve from a group of people solely focused on striking it rich to a community trying to work together?
It's an interesting point, and this is something else we see not just in Fairbanks, but in other communities in Alaska and around the world. These processes are not unique to Alaska or to the United States. So Fairbanks starts as a gold rush town, but quickly, or maybe not so quickly, diversifies. You have the university is established in 1917, although it doesn't actually open for classes until 1922. You have the railroad coming in. It starts out as a real rough and tumble mining town, but eventually you have women coming to Fairbanks. And I'm not talking dance hall girls. I'm talking, wives and mothers and daughters. And so now you have schools and their women become business entrepreneurs in their own right, which of course diversifies the community in a number of ways. And so as the community grows and diversifies, it takes on, of course, a unique character, often endemic to the place itself. One of the really interesting things about Fairbanks is the introduction of the airplane and the automobile, right? Because in those early years, the streets are fairly narrow, very close together. The core of downtown Fairbanks, for anyone who's been there, is pretty tightly packed in because, of course, at the time it was established, it needed to be. People were walking or on horseback, and there were no cars, and so the streets sort of reflect the transportation options that were available to people at the time. Now you bring in an automobile. Now it's suddenly possible to expand the reaches of the town much farther than could have been envisioned prior to the automobile. And so this is very obvious when you look at a street map of Fairbanks, this core downtown that's packed with streets very close together, and then everything starts to spread out a little bit, and that spreading out can then be dated to the introduction of the automobile. Same with the airplane. When the airplane comes along in the 1920s, you need a place to land and to take off. And so you have in Fairbanks and Anchorage and other communities an airstrip that's put in somewhere, usually just off of downtown, for those planes to land and to take off. And this is why we have the Park Strip in Anchorage, for example. This is why we have, the Johansson Expressway in Fairbanks. There's nothing particularly scenic or regal about it, but it exists in many ways because the land for it had once been a runway immediately adjacent to downtown. And so now that expressway is then a convenient way for getting from downtown out to these outlying areas. So looking at these maps of these cities and trying to sort of overlay them with the history of when these technological and social developments were introduced, it really begins to make sense of why the street goes in this direction, why it's this wide and not that wide, why it expands here but not there. These processes, I think, are very telling about our past and where we've come from.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and I'm talking to Ross Cohen about the birth of the Alaskan city. We talked a bit about what it took for people to make the trip to Alaska.
Well, you know, in many ways, the answer to that is just brute determination, right? Where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, a prime example of all of these things that I'm talking about, and then in reference to your question, is the Richardson Highway, or as it was known at the time, the Valdez-Fairbanks Trail, right? I mean, at the time that that trail was put in, there's no Anchorage. Anchorage doesn't become the political and economic center of Alaska, really, in many ways, until World War II. And so in the late 19th century, the early 1900s, people would come by boat up the Inside Passage, Sitka, Juneau, and then on northward. And then to access, the interior in Fairbanks, a trail goes from Valdez north. And that trail initially is, well, it's a mushing trail. It's a dog sled trail in the winter, which means that the roadhouses along the Richardson are essentially what a dog team can travel, or what a man walking the trail in the winter by himself could cover in a day. So they're, you know, 15 to 20 miles apart. A dog team, of course, is going to go much farther than that. But the roadhouses were spaced in such a way as to make it convenient for people to travel. What that means then, in a social context, is that for many people in the year, say, 1910, their mental map of Alaska was of the steamboat route coming up through the Inside Passage in the southeast, and then overland via the Valdez-Fairbanks Trail. Those roadhouses where they stopped were not merely points along the route, they became the route for people. People thought of the route in terms of, I'm going to stop here, and then tomorrow night I'll stop here, and oh, I remember the last time I was there, they had a really good, you know, chili in the kitchen, and so I hope they have that again. So it's these types of sort of mental images, this fixed mental and physical memory that becomes the means by which people engage and then conceptualize Alaska. Well, that all changes, of course, because Anchorage is founded, and then the railroad goes from Seward, not from Valdez, goes from Seward to Anchorage, and then on up into the interior. Eventually, the Parks Highway is constructed, connecting Fairbanks and Anchorage. And so the mental map for travelers, for people in Alaska today, may have nothing to do with the Richardson. So it's the same sort of process. But the manner with which we conceptualize this place where we live changes over time based on all of these social constructs, which is really what roadhouses and today hotels and restaurants and roads really are.
You've been listening to Sesquicentennial Stories with historian and author Ross Cohen. On part two, we will talk about present-day challenges of the Alaskan city and Alaskan exceptionalism. This series is sponsored by the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.